This is the takeaway for Wednesday, March 1st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Well, with his kingdom of governance laid out before him, House, the Senate, the Supreme Court, all the generals, President Donald Trump dared to surprise last night and appeared to revel in being commander-in-chief.
To those allies who wonder what kind of a friend America will be, look no further than the heroes who wear our uniform. Our foreign policy calls for a direct, robust, and meaningful engagement with the world.
In a primetime address to a joint session of Congress Tuesday night, President Donald Trump, whose critics say he doesn't read, read for an hour off of teleprompter.
To any in Congress who do not believe we should enforce our laws, I would ask you this one question. What would you say to the American family that loses their jobs, their income, or their loved one because America refused to uphold its laws and defend its borders?
I guess what I'm saying here, this was a real speech. Congressional leaders who are weary of White House chaos were charged up and enthused by this real presidential-sounding speech, which called for some big-idea projects, some even worthy of the opposition.
Crumbling infrastructure will be replaced with new roads, bridges, tunnels, airports, and railways gleaming across our very, very beautiful land.
So we assembled three voters. We've got a Republican who voted for Trump, Cheryl St. Germain, a former restaurant owner in Marco Island, Florida. We've got a Democrat who voted for Trump, Kenneth Lancey, a business turnaround expert from Cleveland, author of Working for the Greater Good of All, Really. And we've got a Republican who didn't vote for Trump, Hal Scoggins, an attorney from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to all three of you.
It's good to be here.
John.
All right.
Thank you.
So we're kind of sitting around on the couch here. We've just heard this speech. What are your impressions?
Well, this is Ken Lancey. I was very impressed with the speech. And although I say I'm impressed, it's what I expected, that President Trump would deliver. He is a very different president. He has delivered a speech that we've heard a lot of these parts in the past from other presidents. And unfortunately, politicians have not delivered on any of those promises. And I do believe that for the first time, America has the chance to have a president who is not a politician, who's going to come in here and do what needs to be done for the American people.
All right. Well, sounds like Ken's happy. Hal?
I think Ken put his finger on one of the things that people were hoping for from President Trump, which is someone who's not a traditional politician and doesn't act like a traditional politician. My other impression was there's a lot of ideas there. Now the real question is, how do you make them work? How do you put them into action? And especially, how do you do that with people on both sides of the aisle who have some skepticism about some of those ideas?
Anybody nervous last night before this speech began? Cheryl?
Okay, it's my turn. I was nervous, and I was not expecting him to be as dynamic as he was, because we all know that President Trump does not say what we want him to say. In the past, he has disappointed, he's embarrassed, and he just goes his own way. This speech was to perfection. It was intelligent. It was heartfelt. He was sincere. He was soft, but yet forceful. I was totally blown away. And as I'm watching, the one word that came to mind was La La Land. And I didn't see the movie at all, but it was like this perfect world, what he was describing. I felt great about it. I left, you know, with real positive, good feelings.
Totally blown away, says Cheryl. La La Land is her description. Anybody got highlights? Anybody remember any moments that really, you know, good or bad, or even in, you know, shots of the audience?
Well, I was very disappointed in the lack of participation from the other side. I am a lifelong Democrat, and I voted for Obama's first term, and I had great optimism for hope and change. What I have found out about politics and having gotten involved several years ago running for mayor of Cleveland is that politics is a dirty game. It isn't about Democrats or Republicans. It's about keeping outsiders out. When he announced, I immediately supported him, knowing what he was going to go up against. I have met him a number of times, and I can tell you that the man you saw last night is the man he is.
Although there were a lot of politicians in that hall, Hal Scoggins, and they all seemed very, very much bonded with Donald Trump. I mean, he's going to be relying on politicians to get these promises made into reality.
Well, I'll agree with Ken that one side certainly seemed bonded with Trump. The other side did not seem bonded with Trump. But that, to me, again, that's not a surprise in this type of speech, nor would I have necessarily expected real specifics out of this type of speech. That doesn't surprise me. But I do think one of the important things about where we are politically right now is people need to come together and hear each other. And there is a vast group in America that feels like they haven't been heard for quite some time. That's a big part of what got Trump elected. And I think the politicians on both sides of the aisle need to pay attention to that, need to hear that, and need to start governing in a different sort of way. And as Americans, I think we in the citizenry need to do the same thing. It doesn't do any good to call each other un-American. It doesn't do any good to simply listen to ourselves talk and people that are like us. We need to hear what other people who feel marginalized have to say.
Cheryl, what did you make of, I have to say, Ryan Owens' widow there in the hall? I mean, tears streaming down her face. The whole hall standing. This is the Navy SEAL, the wife of the Navy SEAL who died in the raid in Yemen, that apparently yielded no intelligence, despite what the president said last night. Cheryl, did your heart go out to this woman? Did you feel it was a little bit much?
Personally, it was a bit much. I don't feel they did that on purpose. I feel they were feeling her loss, and I took it personal because I am a widow, and not like my husband, you know, died for our country. But I had that emotion, and I felt her loss. It was definitely – they were building on it for sure, but I was okay with that. They were – it was human and
– sincere.
It didn't bother me.
But you got something to say there, Ken?
Yeah, it was very, very heartfelt, very sincere, and it's a tragedy. I mean, what can you say about it? And when you see somebody have that raw emotion, you can't help but have it affect you. And at that moment, the only thing we can do to honor her husband is to applaud, is to support, is to feel her pain. And I think that that's what the group of people there last night did. This was heartfelt. I mean, this is what America's about. I mean, we've lost a soldier, and we have to take this more seriously about sending men and women into war and then pulling out of places without saying, well, we have control. I mean, those lives in Iraq have really been lost in vain, and that tears me up.
Did anyone ask themselves, you know, sitting on the couch together, you three, wait a minute, we're in a war in Yemen?
The reason that I didn't is because, in a certain sense, I wouldn't say war, but we have issues all over the globe. And it's not a secret that Yemen has been a hotbed of activity in that area. And it's not like this was a war action. This was something else.
Cheryl?
No, I personally feel that our country, we have so much anger and so much fear. And with the Democrats and Republican being against, I just felt last night that some of the words that came across from President Trump was, let's get together. You know, let's be on the same side. It's senseless to try to get things done and not see eye to eye. And there's so much right now going on in the American people, anger and fear. Trump is only going to be successful if everyone gives him a chance, you know, opportunity.
I want the three of you to think about a promise that he made in this speech. And come to a conclusion and then sort of report to me after your discussion that we'll listen to of which what it is you're most going to be watching over the next year.
That's tough. You know, my first thought, of course, is healthcare, because that's going to be so challenging. Mm-hmm. It is such a mess. And it took so long to imply it and get it going and understand it. And now just to take it away, I totally support Obamacare being changed to a workable financial. Right now it's a disaster. So I'm going to be involved in caring about all of it. But that was the first thing that came to my mind, was the health care.
That's a critical area that is going to require both Trump and Congress and others to be involved. And it's big and it's complicated, and it involves more than just saying we're going to move forward and we're going to make insurance cheaper. It involves a lot of moving pieces, and it's got to be thought out before it's done. And I think that's one thing that I will be looking for him that's different than the first couple of weeks of his presidency, where it seems like things were done before they were thought out, and then they had to be stopped and redone. And that's not a good way to govern. And I think he's seeing that. And whether he can change appropriately is going to be something to see. And the Affordable Care Act issues, that's certainly a good litmus test for that.
Ken, is this the litmus test, or is something else in this speech the thing that you're going to really watch over the next year as a sign that Trump's going to be able to make good on all those promises that have disappointed you over the last two administrations?
Yeah, well, probably the most important one is to get the economy going and to be able to give the tax cuts that are necessary for business to be able to want to invest. Also, what he's doing with keeping jobs here and creating jobs here.
All right, here's the disagreement. So Cheryl and Hal, it's healthcare, but Ken says, no, it's jobs and the economy. What do you think? The economy stupid or move ahead on healthcare?
And he's made promises on all of them. So, yeah, I mean, to me, there's no single litmus test. He's a president that has said he wants to do a lot. We'll see what happens.
Cheryl, you got one last chance here. I'll give you the last word.
I'm going with the economy, healthcare. I just want to rattle them all off. Safety, foreign, immigrant. It's just he's got a lot of challenges, and I have confidence, and it's going to take time. It's not going to be in the next 60 days. It's going to a year from now,
Right.
We're going to be in much better strength to jobs and support.
Well, let's check with you guys in a year. Cheryl, Ken, and Hal, thank you so much.
Thank you very
much. Thank
you,
John.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. The one word that came to mind was La La Land.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much there.
2017 has seen a wave of anti-Semitic vandalism. Over 100 headstones were tipped last week in Philadelphia and St. Louis. Since January, there have been 100 incidents of bomb threats targeting Jewish community centers and Jewish day schools, according to the National JCC organization. 31 of those bomb threats occurred just this past Monday, when 23 centers and schools were targeted. David Stuhlbin, director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Ann Arbor, experienced evacuations twice in the past year, and he says there is a menacing tension in the air.
I think that the divisiveness that perhaps we've seen going on for so long in politics and has moved down into the electorate to a point where we are simply all oppositional to one another. Somehow people have gotten the idea that they have permission to attack others that are not like them.
And I guess the question is how they got that permission. The president last night, in addressing this question, said that we are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil. That is true, and I applaud him for saying that, but there's just something a little more nuanced in the ways in which people get the feeling that they can go ahead and do these kinds of hate crimes. Can you sort of unpack that a little bit?
Well, I think, you know, we've gone through, what, over a year now since the campaign began, where the president really appealed to, I think, some of the basest natures of people. The anti-immigration piece, building a wall, keeping out those bad hombres, all of these kinds of things that come in feed people's fears and feed people's concerns. And when you have head people from Breitbart, which feeds this kind of white power thing normally, then what's happening is you are giving a subtle message that the government is behind you, and that unleashes stuff. The president has the power to do, in his words, military action to, you know, round up and deport undocumented workers. What if he put those kinds of efforts and resources behind finding out who's doing all of this?
You had an evacuation within the last, you know, couple of weeks, right?
2 days ago.
Right. And as this was happening, young people being evacuated from Jewish community centers, what questions were they asking?
Well, you know, we had 175 children under the age of 11 in our building. Fortunately, we train for stuff like this a lot. We had our first experience last May. We handle things very smoothly. But imagine being a parent of a six-month-old and getting called in the middle of your workday saying that your kids are being evacuated because of a bomb threat. Imagine what happens, you know, when all of a sudden you're in your normal day and you get this notice, evacuate the premises immediately. What does that do to them? And, it takes 2 days to get everything back to normal again, even though you're only out of the building for 2 or 3 hours.
I guess I'm wondering if there's any evidence, David Shulman, that the kids see some cloud hanging over their lives as a result of this tone that you describe that may have motivated these anti-Semitic crimes around the country.
I can't speak for everyone. 2 days ago, 24 Jewish community centers and Jewish day schools experienced this. I can talk only to our specific situation. I don't think the kids feel a cloud. I wonder if some of the parents do. And, you know, a third of our people aren't Jewish. How do they feel about it?
What's going to change it?
There are a lot of disaffected, you know, people out in the community who resent any kind of minority. And until they get the message very strongly that this is not acceptable, and not just in words, I would love to see law enforcement looking for and searching out more of these hate groups and making some arrests and stopping them that way. Otherwise, it's just going to continue. Fortunately, with the 90-plus incidents that we've had since the middle of January, there has not been a single bomb yet, and I hope there never will be. But the fact that the FBI has not been able to identify anyone doing it means there's a pretty sophisticated operation going on just with these calls. And besides that, every day there are a few, if not several, instances of anti-Semitism, be it graffiti, be it cemetery desecrations or whatever, going on every day all over the country. So there's a fair number of people involved in this.
Is there something that you've noticed that you've never seen before in your life in the United States?
The closest thing to it, I think, that I can remember is the 1970s during the oil embargo. But I don't recall this kind of overt action. I recall more of bumper stickers and you know, different kinds of threats and anti-Semitic expressions, but not what we're seeing right now. It's much more alarming, and it's also alarming because we've been watching this grow in Europe for several years. And it seems like now it's simply crossed the ocean, and now we're also experiencing it here.
David Shulman is the director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Ann Arbor, speaking to us from Michigan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
He's been gone. Well, be 18 years in March.
He would always have a smile on his face, just like everything was great. And you know, he was just dying inside.
It just seems like something's got to go wrong.
He's going to walk back out that door with us tomorrow. We aren't going to be staying.
This will be it. Last time.
Hopefully, a big part of his life ahead of him.
It is going to be a ride.
It's just been so long. I keep waiting for him to come get me.
This week, we've already tasted the first few hours of freedom for Aaron Glasscock, set free after nearly 20 years in federal prison. We've heard his family's emotional anticipation of getting Aaron back, and you can check out the first two chapters of our story at thetakeaway.org/lifeafterprison. Now, Chapter 3, The Release. Will the bonds of 18 years behind bars simply slip away? Takeaway producer Dana Roberson takes us there.
Aaron Glasscock is in the back seat, sitting snugly between his mother, Pigeon, and close family friend, Eddie. As the family car pulls away from the Manchester Federal Correctional Institution, 18 years are in the rearview mirror. There is no map for where Aaron is headed.
I'm still a little nervous there. It's just been so long. I keep waiting for him to come get me. Hold up, we made a mistake. You gotta go back.
No! I don't want to go back. But Aaron has to get to a real place, a halfway house in Louisville, Kentucky. It's about 170 miles away, and there's a deadline.
What'd they say? You have to be there when?
12:30. Let's see. Got to be there at 12:30. Gives the phone number. Says if we get any traffic or anything like that.
I got Ted already.
Did I leave my phone with you, Pigeon?
Eddie mentions his misplaced phone. Aaron stops thinking about his misplaced life.
I'll see what that looks like.
There are new gadgets to learn about.
I didn't quite have those things whenever I was out.
The most popular phone when he went to prison in 1999 was not a smartphone.
Well, they didn't have cameras on them. They didn't have anything. And this is the selfie.
Oh, boy, Aaron.
Hey, what is that?
That tells you your message got a message.
You're going to be hearing it a lot on the way. It's going to go, it's been doing it all morning up here. Ding, 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 ding.
There's a ringtone.
We can put a ringtone on yours. Like, free at last, free at last. It's like God Almighty.
It'd be a good one.
Aaron is adjusting to freedom all around him. As he stares through the window of the SUV, he can feel that this isn't a prison bus.
It's feeling pretty good. I'm still a little nervous. Just riding in the vehicle like this is a little queasy on my stomach.
As his stomach settles, Aaron begins to talk about the future stretching out before him. It starts as a simple to-do list.
My one list is things that I need to do, you know, like getting my license. I've got a lot of the other stuff already, get a phone, get a job, you know, just small things that I need to get done. And then the other list are things for me to watch out for. You know, don't rush into relationships, don't rush into a permanent job just because, you know, you need a job. Don't rush into, you know, social situations or whatever. Like I said, most of them are just, you know, about taking your time. And there's other things to watch out for, you know, being in crowds. If I'm not comfortable there, to distance myself enough from it or not put myself in the situation to be in the middle of a crowd. You know, just things like that that I just want to make myself and keep myself aware of so that I don't fall, you know, victim to anything of that nature.
Aaron has what a lot of departing inmates don't. He's educated, a semester shy of graduating college. He has the devotion and support of his family, and he is motivated.
I feel good about, you know, chance of getting any job, as far as, you know, a regular job. But, you know, ultimately I want to get something I can, you know, make a career out of and move up into a company and stuff like that. Just, I mean, I don't have a lot of certificates or certifications or whatever. No, but I've got 11 years experience in production and manufacturing and customer service, data processing, data analyst. I've done a little bit of it all. I mean, I've got the experience just getting someone to, you know, to bet on me enough to give me the opportunity to use it and show them what I can do. And, you know, I'm only a semester from a degree. I got like a semester and I got BS in biology.
His optimism is guarded. Aaron knows his identity as an inmate is not invisible.
I think that I'll be looked at differently just because I do have a criminal history, that people are going to look at you differently. I mean, it's, you see it all the time. It's always there, it seems like. They talk about it as soon as you know you've done your time, but it follows you for the rest of your life. The administration in Kentucky, they're doing the ban the box for state jobs now because, I mean, you know, a lot of your employers, you know, they have a box there. If you got a felon, and they just basically, oh, he's got that, and they just toss you to the side without even glancing a second time at it. Whereas, you know, a lot of these ones that you're throwing aside would probably be one of the best workers you've ever had because you give them a shot. They're going to be super loyal to you, and they're going to work hard. But just getting them to give you that shot is huge.
According to Bureau of Justice Statistics, there were more than 1.5 million state and federal prisoners incarcerated in 2014. 636,000 were released in the same year. And while sentencing reform has increased the numbers of inmates released from prison, employers and communities are still working through how to integrate them into society.
America has 4% of the population and 25% of the incarcerated population. So, you know, what, 1 in 5, 1 in 10 people have someone or has been themselves or know someone that's been in prison or on probation. So I think, you know, with that, you almost have to have a change.
Tomorrow, we make one last stop on Aaron's journey as he meets up with family outside the halfway house, where he will begin his transition back into reality.
Okay, I have one question.
Uh-oh, yes. One question.
Do you know how to dab?
All right, whip and nay-nay.
Okay, so this is how you whip.
Whip.
Like a punch.
Nay-nay-nay.
For The Takeaway, I'm Dana Roberson.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
In America, people opposed to abortion have to accept that it has been legal since the Roe versus Wade ruling. But what they don't have to accept and have successfully fought in court to make a principle of law is that taxpayers cannot be compelled to pay for or subsidize abortions. To do so amounts to the state interfering with a religious principle. Now, plaintiffs in Houston are trying to launch the same principle regarding same-sex marriage in arguments today before the Texas Supreme Court. Same-sex marriage may be legal, the argument goes, but by extending municipal benefits or subsidies to same-sex couples, citizens opposed to gay marriage on religious grounds are being forced to pay for it. Evan Wolfson was president of the Freedom to Marry organization that fought to legalize same-sex marriage across the country. Hello, Evan. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Abortion comes with a procedure that has a cost that goes on an invoice, which makes it a very sort of specialized category of actions related to the federal treasury, if you want to put it that way. Same-sex marriage doesn't show up that way. How does the municipal subsidy or benefit subsidy function differently than the way abortions are excluded from government subsidy?
Well, we didn't fight and work hard and win the right to same-sex marriage. We won and worked for and have achieved the freedom to marry itself. There is not different kinds of marriage depending on who you are and where you are and how others feel about you. You're married. And once you're married, the state must treat you equally and with respect, recognizing the same dreams, the same needs, the same aspirations, the same responsibilities, the same protections for married people. The state can choose not to attach a particular benefit or responsibility to marriage, but it can't pick and choose amongst married people based on whether it likes them or not.
Now, of course, that's what's being tested in this challenge, right?
Well, that's what the anti-gay side is now desperately trying to do in order to keep stoking this anti-gay exclusion that they have wanted to perpetuate in the law. But that's precisely what court after court after court, and I will add, the American people have rejected. The American people have seen with their own eyes that gay people are human beings, are fellow citizens, are also taxpayers, and have the same aspirations, the same needs, the same desires, and the same entitlement under the Constitution to be treated with respect under the law. And that's what the Texas Supreme Court originally recognized when they said they're not going to hear this meritless case. But under tremendous political pressure, these elected judges agreed to now hear a case that is clearly meritless. And I'm really confident that they are going to throw it out, because to do otherwise would be simply to put themselves in defiance to the Constitution and to the Supreme Court and to the majority will of the American people.
If this lawsuit succeeds before the Texas Supreme Court, what's its federal disposition?
I think it is going to be resoundingly rebuffed by the Supreme Court as defiance of the rule of law in this country.
Is it possible that the very same people who opposed same-sex marriage also endorsed civil unions as a way around it and actually endorsed giving same-sex couples the benefits as long as they didn't say they were married?
That's exactly right. What this stunt is about is a political pandering job on the part of some of the politicians in Texas, together with the hardcore anti-gay opposition who have never accepted gay people as full human beings, let alone as full citizens, who have not accepted marriage, who have made any argument depending on the winds of the day in order to further that agenda. Fortunately, that agenda is not an agenda shared by the vast majority of the American people and the majority of Texans. And I really believe that when the court looks at the clear case, together with the command of the Constitution as reflected in two Supreme Court rulings, they will uphold the rule of law and reject this effort to demean gay people and to turn the clock back in a way that defies the Constitution.
Speaking to us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, he's the founder and president of Freedom to Marry, Evan Wolfson. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
A film documenting Evan's organization and its fight to legalize same-sex marriage, also called Freedom to Marry, comes out this Friday. We've heard from a number of Indian Americans this week speaking about the difficulties of living in two worlds. Profound uncertainty from a teenager in Kansas City where the shooting of two Indian men took place a week ago. An actress spoke with us yesterday about how creating a theater piece helped her to understand how her American and Indian identities have had to find a way to live together. For musician Zeeshan Bhagwati, the best way to understand his journey from one culture to another is to hear his radical cover of George Perkins' soulful track, Crying in the Streets.
I see somebody marching, marching down the street, yeah.
Zeeshan draws similarities between the fight and the struggle for civil liberties in the 60s and that same fight today. He credits his parents, who immigrated to the States decades ago, for raising him on a healthy dose of soul music, two souls in one very American musician.
The music of James Brown and B.B. King was just as synonymous in my soundtrack of my childhood as was the film music of Muhammad Rafi or Kishore Kumar, or for that matter, Mehdi Hassan, who was, I think, the greatest singer to have ever come from the Indian subcontinent. My germination as a child, you know, it was centered in all this really awesome stuff.
Awesome stuff and America's less than awesome racism and other forms of intolerance. South Asians, Bhagwati learned, were treated differently than blacks and Latinos, especially in a city like Chicago.
This is a very race-conscious place. From a very early age, I was very conscious of the fact that I was a person of color. From kindergarten to third grade, I went to an all-Muslim school, which was amazing because all the other kids, you know, they were Indian, Pakistani, or Arab, and I fit in with them, and their moms, you know, made the same sandwiches, you know, that we took to lunch. Nobody was making fun of, like, you know, the Indian food that I had for lunch, you know what I'm saying? It was just comfortable. I think
you were sheltered.
The culture shock. Yeah. I was sheltered. Yeah, I was sequestered, and it was blissful, really. When I switched over to public school, that was quite a culture shock because I think there were two Indian kids in school and in my class, and we kind of had a solidarity in that. It was just kind of like, okay, we're going to get made fun of today, and it's okay. And we just kind of had like group therapy sessions over that, you know. But in all seriousness, Chicago is just like that. You're made very aware of what you are.
Do you know the story of crying in the streets, and how does it relate to the reason why you decided to cover it?
I chanced upon this George Perkins crying in the streets. I said, my goodness, what's this all about? So I looked him up, and I read that he penned that song as a reaction to the assassination of Dr. King in 1968. And the song came out 2 years in 1970. It's an outpouring of his own grief at observing the funeral. You know, I see somebody marching in the streets. I see somebody crying in the streets. I see somebody dying in the streets. And I think that a lot of people, including myself, in these streams of consciousness, you just sort of see images of whatever it is that's going on. And for me, I knew Sandra Bland in high school, actually, and we were in the same circle of friends. She had just been murdered in Texas, and I was always a supporter of Black Lives Matter. But, you know, when Sandy was killed, well, it just hit home more, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my, Sandy, wait, I knew, what, you know.
Well, you found
right
yourself,
to each other in prom,
you found yourself
yeah.
sort of swirled into the Black Lives Matter movement. You go from, oh, I support that, to that's outrageous, to realizing that this experience is actually your experience that you're having in your own way.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I'm very aware of my privilege, you know, growing up, you know, Indian American. I mean, we're privileged. I mean, we have access to jobs. We have access to education, to healthcare, housing, et cetera, that disenfranchised indigenous minorities like Native Americans, Blacks, Latinos, they don't have, you know. It just became a little bit more personal when Sandy was
sure.
killed. And then the rise of Trump and this whole election, you know, this man announces his candidacy, goes on this, you know, demagogic rampage. All those things going on just sort of, you know, were part of my stream of consciousness. And then that just gave this song its own unique relevance, and I was just, I got to do this.
When did you come up with a title for your new album, which is out in April?
Just a couple months ago, actually. Honestly, I like that it does have sort of a tongue-in-cheek aspect to it. There's the political implications and the socio-political implications of the title in light of what's going on with the immigration ban. That's very personal to me, you know. I mean, my parents are immigrants, for God's sakes. If this kind of nonsense was going on, that we wouldn't have been here, you know. I take pride in the fact that we have contributed to the fabric of America. There's so many levels of vetting that are going on, and I feel like I've just been vetted for better or for worse. You know, my music is vetted all the time. Everything's vetted these days, you know.
How do you use this record to celebrate all the various voices, languages, and influences in your background?
Heavily featured on the album are instruments that are idiomatic in their sound. And I say idiomatic because they are cornerstones of Indo-Pakistani music. Instruments such as the harmonium and the tanpura, which has a very sinewy sound, as well as some of the tunes that are on there that are in Urdu. One's in Urdu and the other one's in Punjabi. And some of the other songs have a cross between Urdu and English. For example, Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City, the intro of that is in Urdu, and then I transition to English. Part of the soundtrack of my childhood was soul music of India and Pakistan. Mm. And I'm telling you, I say that because it's the stuff that was really about, you know, being down and out of poverty. And my father came from abject poverty. And all these things are, you know, sort of come to a swell in the album.
Zeeshan, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Zeeshan Bhagwati is a musician based in Chicago. His debut solo album, Vetted, will be out in April. Love listening to that. That's our show for this hour. We heard earlier this hour about the wave of anti-Semitic violence across the U.S. Has your community experienced that?
My name is Jacqueline Thomas from Portland, Oregon. I've been touched, dismayed by the anti-Semitism. I have wonderful Jewish friends who I will defend and protect to the end.
Hi, my name is Johnny from Madisonville, Kentucky, and I don't see the problem as more groups. There might be some existing groups that have been more emboldened than they were before to act out publicly. But in my community in West Kentucky, I have not seen or heard of any increased amount of hate crimes.
Weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us the story of what's going on in your community. That's our number. You can join our conversation. Keep it going. The Takeaways Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, a website building platform that helps anyone register a domain and create their own website. More at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move. New York Presbyterian, where two Ivy League medical schools combine in their commitment to teach, practice, and expand the frontiers of medicine. Amazing things are happening here. More at nyp.org/amazingadvances.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.